both know he's alive.
But you know where he is.
Halloween 5. This time, they're ready. This time, he's unmasked. And this time, he's back with a vengeance. Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Pod and the Pendulum, the horror movie podcast. It is dedicated to covering every single horror movie franchise, one movie and one entry at a time. I'm your host, Mike Snoonian, joined once again by my co-host, Jerry Smith. Jerry, how are we feeling tonight?
I am doing great. I'm so excited about this one. I know I say that every episode, but like throughout my whole life, I've always found myself defending Halloween 5 from everyone, and especially these days where people list like Halloween 6 high up and they're obviously on crack. I think Halloween 5 needs some defending.
Yeah, you know, I think you're gonna have to,
You're like, no,
this is the one I could take or leave a little bit. So, you know, this is gonna be, I'm excited because I get to hang back a little bit tonight. I think I'm in the middle of editing our Halloween 4 episode, and I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, Jesus, I'm so sick of hearing my own voice right now. Like, so we're going to edit that down to like a good solid, like 18 minutes, I think, when all is said and done. So we have a great guest tonight. I'm really excited for this guest. We have Brian Collins on from Birth, Movies, Death, the author of the Collins Crypt column. He is the author of the book Horror Movie a Day, the book, which is based off his former blog, Horror Movie a Day. And he's also the world's foremost Chevy Chase apologist. Brian Collins, welcome to the show.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on, man. It's great to talk and really happy to have you here. What is it about? Ooh, what happened there?
That's my mother texting me.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. All right. Well, why don't you answer that? Because moms are important. We'll wait a few seconds. That's all right.
Sorry. Let me, you know what? Let me mute her. Hold on.
Wow. Poor mom.
Well, I mean, she's just sending pictures and stuff.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. So my mom was talking to my wife tonight, and she was like, I guess my brother-in-law had surgery. Like, he had a Halloween accident. And, you know, when my mom mentioned this to my wife, like he had surgery because he got in some sort of accident. My wife thought that was some sort of euphemism for something else. And I'm like, when does my mom ever use a euphemism for anything? It's like having a surgery is not a euphemism. All right. We're officially off the rails and we're 2 minutes into recording right now. So, Brian, what is it about Halloween 5 that you hold so near and dear to the heart here?
All right. Like you said earlier, you know, like I find myself defending it a lot because I really don't get the hate. Like, I know it's not a great movie, but it's so much better than its reputation, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't play into too much of the, like, I can't stand when people are like, it's my favorite one because it's the first one I saw kind of stuff. Like, that's just dumb to me. The first Halloween I saw was 4. I'm not going to say Halloween 4 is better than 1, you know. But I do have a nostalgic memory of this one where I got to watch it on the first time. It wasn't the first time I was home alone, but it was the first time I was home alone at night for like an extended period, because it was actually on Halloween, and I think I was like 11. Mm-hmm. And like my sister had gone out to her party and my parents were going to their party, and there was like some overlap between like when my parents left and when my sister got home. Like, there was going to be like an hour and a half in between. They were like, all right, it's fine, like, you can stay, you know, like, by himself for that little bit. Like, what's he gonna do? He's watching a movie, he's not gonna move from the couch. It was Halloween 5, and I got to the barn sequence and I started getting too scared. I had to shut it off and wait till somebody got home.
Really? That's,
yeah. the beloved barn sequence. Mm-hmm. But you know, like, I just, you know, when you're ranking these things, it always ends up in my top half, I think, or at least somewhere mm-hmm. in the middle, you know? And I was like, how do you hate this movie when Resurrection exists, or when, you know, Zombie's first one exists? And
How do you
possibly watch Curse and think, well, at least it's better than 5? Like, I just don't see how that that occurs, like, just because it has a few weird elements. I mean, every one of them from this point on has weird elements in it and things that don't work, including the last one, which I really liked a lot. There are things about that one I really don't like. So it's just like, why does 5 keep getting so much shit? So I defend it. I take the role of good.
So it's 2-1 tonight. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of this. I think it has its high points. And, you know, I think one of the things we do in this show is we very rarely trash a movie. I think there's maybe been only like one or two things we've ever gone really hard in on. It's still better than Mandy, as far as I'm concerned. Like, I would watch this a million times over before I ever would watch Mandy again, as far as I'm concerned. But I think it's a weird, because it's a weird trilogy of movies. You have part 4, 5, and 6, which kind of sort of make up the Thorne trilogy, except that there's no mention of the Thorns at all until part 6. And the only glue that really keeps it together is the fact that you have the character of Jamie, who's played by Daniel Harris in 4 and 5, kind of keeping it together in this. So it's kind of an odd thing. And then once H2O comes out, it's in 1998, it's this trilogy, quote unquote, is kind of thrown to the side at that point. Like, okay, you know, now this is no longer canon. So it's kind of exists in this really weird space, is kind of as far as Halloween movies are concerned.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I agree. And it's interesting. You know, I don't subscribe to the whole Thorne trilogy thing. Like, I love 4 with a passion. I really love 5. I don't like 6. You know, and even though, like, they try to force this kind of mythology with those 3 movies, like, I think you could watch all 3 of them on their own, you know? Like, they're so different from each other that I can never just get on board with the whole trilogy thing.
Well, to me, this is where the movies start to get a little bit more weird, and that continues with part 6. Like, the first 4 movies on their own are pretty straightforward horror movies, right? I mean, there's nothing that's like to... And then when you get to this movie, it starts adding all of these bizarre little elements that I think we're going to get to as we start talking about the movie, like, more in depth overall. But, you know, when this movie... I think part of the reason this movie maybe gets bashed a little bit is just when it came out, because it comes out in 1989. It's less than a year after, or it's 1 year exactly after Halloween 4 comes out. And by this time, like, all of your big franchises are kind of winding down and they're watered down. Elm Street has The Dream Child, which is really the first real stumbling block in that series overall. Friday the 13th had been kind of, I would say Friday the 13th had been floundering around since after part 6. That's starting to wind down. Paramount's looking to dump it at that point and push it onto New Line. And then slasher movies in general, like, are, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week, Jerry, where I was kind of the mindset that slashers are kind of out by like 88, 89. Like, you're not really going to see a lot of really good ones until Scream in 1996. Not to say there aren't any good ones, but the golden age for these movies has kind of passed since then.
Mm-hmm. And this is also the point where, I mean, you mentioned Friday the 13th series. I think there's always a specific film in a series where things do kind of start to get weird, you know? Halloween 5, I mean, yeah, I think that's the beginning of that. You know, Friday the 13th 7, you know what I mean? Like, these are all movies that, like, if you watch the first few Friday the 13th movies, you would never expect that he would go against, you know, someone with telekinesis or, you know... that kind of stuff. Like, it just sounds out there. As much as I love Halloween 5, if you watch John Carpenter's original, and then you say, you know, a few years from now, about 10, 11 years from now, there's going to be a man dressed in black that breaks Michael Myers out of jail with an Uzi, you know, after he tries to go after his niece who can't talk, that might be kind of connected to him, you know, like, you would have laughed. But, you know, the thing is, as weird as Halloween 5 does get, I mean, the Uzi thing, you know, just the Men in Black in general, the bumbling cops. I've always said over a decade now, that Halloween 5 to me is about 80% just absolutely terrifying. I think it's one of the scariest films in the entire series, and 20% off the rails. And to be honest, I am completely on board with that 80% enough to say, you know what? I really love this movie. It's easy for me to overlook the kind of sillier aspects of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you gotta, again, I mean, even with like the ones people love the most after this, which would be what, the two with Jamie, H2O and 2018, it's like, okay, well, for H2O, you have to deal with the absolute worst mask in a series, I think, which is even worse than the Fab mask. And the CGI mask and all the screen humor that has dated the movie really poorly. And the two friends who I think are far more annoying than Tina, you know, and LL Cool J with his fucking,
romance novels.
Yeah. all that stuff is just stupid and bad. And then, 2018, like the dumb Dr. Sartain nonsense. You know, it's just like, all right, you gotta take these movies, you gotta take the good with the bad with these movies. They're not perfect films anymore, and it's about how much you're willing to overlook whatever flaws they may have. And it's just like, if you're just looking for a reason to hate a movie, then you can find anything. You can find reasons to hate the original if you want to look, you know? So it's like, again, I just never have understood the vitriol. I can understand being like, yeah, that one wasn't for me. Like, I wasn't too big of a fan, but like, I mean, I seriously see people ranking it last sometimes, and I'm just like,
Which is weird because, I mean, as crazy and weird as Halloween 5 gets, I mean, like I said, if you would have told me watch the original that this would happen, I'd be like, what? But even more so, if someone had told me, yeah, and the movie that follows it, Michael Myers impregnates his niece because he's ran by a group of senior citizen cults, and Paul Rudd stops him with runes in one of the versions. You know, like, that's the weird thing that I don't get, like the people that just really love Halloween 6, but trash Halloween 5. Like, I get it. Everyone has the kind of movie that they dig. But trashing Halloween 5 when you're, like, super into Halloween 6 is so alien to me. I just do not get it.
Oh, next week is going to be
fun. I know it's not super the topic, but I'm also confused a lot, and I hope you guys get into it on the episode for that. The people that seem to think the two versions of 6 are like night and day, because they're not at all. I mean, they're both, at the end of the day, they're both about the same in terms of like what letter grade you'd throw at them or whatever, letterbox rating or something.
Well,
It's not like the producer's cut magically fixed every single problem. Right. And in fact, that it has others that aren't in the theatrical version.
Yeah.
I think it's, The best version of that movie is somewhere between the two. Like, if you were to, fan edit them or something, you could probably make the best one, but it still wouldn't be, a massive success. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that you would have a pretty solid movie if you were to kind of just take out the best elements of both of those movies. You'd have something that would be a bit more solid. And Brian, to your point, like, as weird as Halloween 5 is, and with the things you can kind of like pick on it for, I would still watch this movie over, say, H2O, which going back and watching H2O, find it mind-blowing that people rank that as like their favorite behind the original, like so many people do. And I understand that, Jamie Lee Curtis is pretty fantastic in that movie, but to me, she's just playing Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, that's one thing that always bugged me about it. She did not feel like Laurie at all. That's what, I mean, and it's like 10 minutes into the movie or something where that is apparent when she says, what did she say? Like, I know you get your sarcasm from my side of the family. Like, when was Laurie sarcastic?
Right.
Like, I don't think Laurie being particularly sarcastic. It's like, I know Jamie Lee Curtis is very sarcastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then like from then on, it was just like, yeah, it's just her, like the Laurie in the new one, while, we can argue all day about how traumatized she was, considering nothing else happened. At least the Laurie felt like Laurie to me.
Right.
Yeah.
And to me, like, the H2O feels like a Scream movie, taking all the elements that made Halloween work so well and just trying to make it feel like a Scream movie, which, it's fun. I'll watch it every now and again, but I would much rather watch Halloween 4, 5, and even 6 over H2O, to be honest.
Quickly speaking on what you guys were talking about, maybe if you took the best parts of Halloween 6 and put them into one movie, it'd be better. Have either of you guys watched that new fan edit of both Rob Zombie's Halloweens?
I didn't watch it. I clicked around on it, and I guess he made it private, which I haven't gone back to confirm that, but somebody told me that they loaded it up and it's private now.
I watched it last night, and it dramatically changes those two movies. Like, it's insane how different the entire just aesthetic feels with those.
I was clicking around, just kind of curious, like, because it was like, I'm combining one and two. I'm like, well, that's an interesting thing. And then I'm like, there's not much of two. Like, it seemed to end, like, 20 minutes into two or something. Like, she's in therapy or whatever.
She's in therapy, and it ends with Michael Myers kind of staring into the night, just being alive still.
Wait, who put this together?
It was just a fan edit. Yeah. But basically what happened was he took Rob Zombie's Halloween, took out all of the kind of like hillbilly stuff from the beginning. I mean, I think it begins with the murders. Very little, if none, of young Michael Myers. He takes all of that, condenses it to be a little tighter, and adds parts of Halloween 2. It's basically a whole new, about hour and 47, I believe, minute movie of Rob Zombie's films, minus all the kind of, like, you know, quote-unquote redneck stuff that everyone kind of complains about.
Interesting. Which is,
like, the impression I got when clicking around, I'm like, they took the Rob Zombie-ness out of it, which, I mean, I'd have to watch the whole thing to be sure, but to me that sounds like a disaster, because I think the one thing I do enjoy about his first one is the stuff he created. It's when he's redoing the Carpenter stuff that I get infuriated or bored. As bad as not, you know, his stuff is kind of nonsense, but it's his nonsense, and I can appreciate that. I can't appreciate him restaging, you know, entire scenes from Carpenter.
Right, and I really like
it. Just like, let's like remake Rob Zombie's Halloween. Let's recut Rob Zombie's Halloween to be even more like John Carpenter's Halloween. I'm like, well. That would, to me, would be even harder to watch, but I don't know. I'd have to watch the whole thing to be sure.
And I really like Halloween 2, Zombies Halloween 2.
I watched that and 5 last week. Like, for this week's, you know, celebration, I decided to watch the two most unfairly maligned entries.
Yeah, and I really like Halloween 2, and I'm looking forward to talking about that when we get to it eventually. Oh my, it feels like it's going to take forever for us to get there, because when Jerry picks what shows we're going to do, it's like, we're not doing it unless it has 10 or more entries in a series. So,
after this, we'll do the Joyride movies. How's that?
Oh, that's fine. I mean,
you can do the Wishcrafts.
All right.
There's like 13 of those.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. God, no, please. Well, once we get to the Amityville Horror, I think there's like 28 entries into, like, that's going to be a half a year. We're going to have to figure something out for that, because I might blow my brains out if we have to do, like, every Amityville Horror movie back to back to back. That's neither here nor there. So this comes out a year after Halloween 4. H4 is pretty successful. I mean, it makes $18 million in the U.S., but the big thing is it's really successful on home video. It's you know, by this time, like, the VHS era is in full bloom, and as good as this H4 does in the box office, probably does like more than double that just in rentals and people buying the movie overall. And one of the things Mustafa Akkad has said is part of the reason he thinks Halloween 5 did so poorly at the box office, it's to date the lowest grossing of any of the Halloween movies, is the fact that, like, people were at that point just getting H4 on videotape and staying home and watching it rather than going to theaters, which maybe don't release the movie. So maybe don't rush the movie out 1 year after and wait until, you know, people see H4 at home first. I don't know. That's just me. That's crazy talk.
Well, here's the thing. You know, there was a good amount of time to develop 4. And I think maybe the quick turnaround between 5, I mean, that could be a part. But, you know, at first I was kind of skeptical of, you know, Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends kind of, you know, being somewhat close, you know, as far as being released in the next couple years. But then again, like, that story seems to actually be planned out, whereas 4 and 5, I mean, 5's notorious for, you know, nobody really knowing what they were doing until, you know, they did it, especially with the Men in Black stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you note that, you know, people had insurance to see it. I just quickly double-checked because I was pretty sure. I watched Halloween. I remember the date I saw Halloween 4 because I broke my arm that night, and it was the same night as a big earthquake in San Francisco, so it's always been easy for me to remember the date. And Halloween 5 was actually already in theaters at that point.
Wow.
You know, and this was my introduction to the series, was 4. So it's just like, if I had rented it a week earlier, I might have been begging my mom to, you know, take me to the movie that weekend. Do they wait? I mean, I'd have to look it up. Do they actually hold Halloween 4 for a year? I know they did that with 6. 6 didn't come out on video until almost a year later, because they wanted to release it on video for the season. But
pretty they do that much. Halloween 4 I mean, too. That would have been... I think we're so used to like a quick turnaround now where things get... You know, video on demand and streaming.
Like 6 months at least. It was usually, you know, it was more, but it was usually at least 6 months.
Right.
But I know for seasonal stuff, they'd sometimes wait the full year just so they could put it out on video for the season.
Let's do a quick look right now. Halloween 4. Carry on, gentlemen. Let's do a quick.
Well, I mean, the quick turnaround, I mean, I think it's kind of where a lot of people kind of got tired of like the Saw series, you know, because you're getting one every year that there's no real anticipation between that. I mean, I remember how long we had to wait for Halloween 6, and especially the answer or the questions that were given in Halloween 5 with the end, you know, it gave us a lot of time to kind of like percolate and like stew on those questions that we had. Whereas like everything with 4, especially that great ending of, you know, Jamie holding, you know, scissors and stuff, like it's barely a year later and we're giving the answers that, you know, a lot of people weren't satisfied with. So I could kind of the frustration, I think, even if I don't particularly agree with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And to answer the other question, it came out for rental in May of 89 and for purchase in October. So, like 6 months and then a year later, you could actually buy the movie. But that's one of the things that Cod said kind of hurt the movie overall, was the fact that it had just been able to buy it on video at that point. So let's talk about
The timing too, because in the movie itself, a lot of it almost seems like it was written as assuming it would come out 2 years later, because everybody is aged up too. Like Jamie was 7 in 4 and she's 9 here. And, Loomis says it's been 12 years and it should be 11. And the else too, I think. So it almost felt at times like they were writing it assuming it would not be out that year. It would be out the following October and then never actually got there.
And I think that just speaks like, because this movie was fast-tracked, it's just very, very sloppy. And this also, I think, would have been right around the time of the writer's strike as well. Am I wrong about that? Like, was this...
No, it was during the strike.
Okay, my bad. I thought that might have been the case. So this was just done way too fast at that point, where a lot of those things, that attention to detail was glossed over. And at that point, the producers were saying, who's going to really look back and kind of catch the stuff overall?
Me!
It cuts to all of us saying, well, us.
You guys should have known about the internet.
So yeah, Jerry, you hit on our next point here. Let's talk about Daniel Harris and Jamie a bit, because you would say one of the things that was really fun to speculate about if you're a fan of Halloween 4 is where this character was going to go in the next movie, because she was pretty much set up as the next Michael at the end of Halloween 4, and that is not going.
I mean, if I remember correctly, I could be wrong, but I mean, I think I remember reading in an interview or something that Shim Bitterman, the guy that kind of wrote the, I think, original draft, wasn't his intention keeping Jamie evil in the next movie before, like, you know, everyone else kind of rewrote it?
It was. I mean, the original idea was Jamie would either be the killer, or that she and Michael would kind of work alongside one another or compete against one another in some sort of like body count type of movie. But that's not the route they go.
Can you imagine the plot
of Freddy versus Jason, where Jamie was killing people and Michael was getting credit and she was getting pissed?
Can you imagine how stressed out Loomis would be with that plot?
It's interesting, though. There's something that I just learned. I don't know if either of you read, this book just came out maybe 2 weeks ago called Taking Shape. And it's the guys that wrote the Clash of the Titans book about all the Freddy versus Jason development. They wrote one about the entire Halloween series development, basically kind of focusing on like what didn't happen, like script ideas and things that changed along the way versus, you know, a million stories that we've all heard before. And one thing in the section on five, the writer, Michael Jacobs, he said that as far as he knew, what he was told was that Mustafa was anti Jamie being evil.
Oh.
And also that because don't forget, this is an independent, these are the 4 and 5 are independently released through, you know, was it Galaxy or something like that? Like, it was basically them. I mean, it wasn't a studio putting these movies in theaters. So they had to work directly with the theaters to like get those counts. And apparently it was like the theater owners were also like, we're not going to book a movie about an evil 9-year-old child murdering people, like, you know, 1,000 screens. So as far as the writer, Michael Jacobs, was concerned, that was never going to be in play, like, from the higher ups. It wasn't so much like Dominique, the director, being like, no, you know, I guess he was not a big idea. He wasn't a fan of that idea anyway, but even if he was, it looks like it was never going to happen. And that does track with Mustafa's kind of history of being like, we're not doing a movie without Michael, you know, kind of thing. I don't know how many people are aware that the Resurrection, you know, as much as I dislike Resurrection, we cannot blame it, Rick Rosenthal or whoever wrote it, for the whole stupid paramedic thing, because all that stuff was decided during H2O and even partially shot during H2O, where they already had that, you know, that loophole in place where it was going to be a paramedic that Laurie killed. Mm-hmm. That was like their backup plan. You know, if H2O flopped, then fine, that's how it would end. But because it was a hit, they're going to keep going, and they already knew that that's how they were going to get around, shot it then. So it's like you think of that, and then you're like, oh yeah, there's no way in hell Mustafa would also have allowed Michael to actually be dead or sit out for a movie to let Daniel Harris be a killer.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I mentioned on the last episode, I remember after H2O came out, there was a poll on the HalloweenMovies.com, like right after H2O came out, and it was basically them asking what direction they would want it to go. And I remember even being like 18 or whatever when H2O came out, thinking like, why would you even ask us this? Like, do you guys just not know what you want to do? Like, don't listen to us. Like, I don't even know what I want for breakfast today. Like, you know, who am I to control the direction of that?
But I can't imagine like a huge segment of people voted for We Need Busta Rhymes.
Yeah.
You know, like,
like, I want a webcast.
Yeah, I can't imagine, like, we need, like, kung fu in this movie. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine that was, like, even a choice for the...
That or, like, we need at least one mention.
Series return.
Right? We need at least one mention of Pulp Fiction in this one, obviously.
Yeah, we need it to be overly Canadian.
Basically needs to be Strange Brew 2, except with Michael Myers, basically. But what do we think of what they do with the character of Jamie in this movie? Because she's basically a little girl version of Lassie, where she can't speak, and everyone is like, is Michael Myers trapped down a well? Like, that's pretty much, like, she just, like, utters, like, throughout the movie. It's really weird to turn her into a kind of a mute, I would say.
It is, but at the same time, you know, one thing that I've learned watching Halloween 5, even from the first time I watched it as a kid, you know, I think I was like 8 or 9 when it came out, and I remember thinking, like, even from the opening credits, you know you're in for something completely different. I mean, you have a very aggressive opening with the pumpkin. I mean, you get Michael Myers escaping by floating on water. I mean, right from the like, so when Jamie pops up a few minutes later, you know, mute, screaming, you know, with no sound, I'd already seen some weird ass shit by that time in the movie, right? that it never bothered me. I think what bothers me, I think her kind of sidekick in the movie, I think bothers me a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, I know that, you know, Jeff Landon, I mean, he put everything into it, so it's not even his fault. You know, he went to like a specialist to learn how to stutter properly. But I think that's one of the things about Halloween 5 that does bug me, is that it never comes off genuine with that character. It comes off so forced with the stuttering that it's just like, you know, like it just feels weird to me. But Jamie doesn't bother me, but the kid does. The other one does.
I don't know how woke it is to say this, but like, of all the kids there, why is the stuttering one the one that has to be her interpreter? Like, come on. Like, there's other kids there that can come over and get this information out a little quicker.
I know. There had to be at least one more, like, observant kid that could have helped her out.
And, like, it's weird that they, like, she can't write? they don't make much of an effort to explain why she can't just write shit down.
It just gets to like some of these really bizarre choices that.
But I mean, it's you. One of you said it on the little doc, the little Google Doc that we've had, I think, and then I've heard it before anyway. You know, there's definitely like a giallo kind of influence in this.
Yeah.
And if you watch it as a giallo, then none of this stuff matters because it's like, this is like the most coherent giallo, if it is a giallo. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much nonsense in those movies that you just like, fine. But I don't know if it's like a weird disconnect because they're a foreign film to us, and therefore we're like, maybe that's just how it is there, you know? Like,
right.
Well, that, and I mean, everyone gives kind of Dominique so much shit for the movie, but I think the things that Dominique added to it, like, I think add to its charm. I mean, everything from telling Don Shanks to play Michael Myers, like, what is it, like, wood through water or something like that? It's just like, what does that even mean? But after you hear that and you see Michael Myers walking, you're like, okay, that makes sense. You know, Jamie can't. Right, but the way that he visually does it with like the glass, you know, over the camera, like it works.
I thought it was a continuity error. I'm like, she was writing on a window, now it's paper. What happened?
But no, but these things.
I do not understand directorial flourishes.
Right. No, but like those things that he added to it, I think, like I said, add to the charm of the movie. Like it is so out there, and I don't mean like. You know, I in no way mean that, like, oh, Halloween 5 is so crazy that I love it in an ironic sense. It's so bad, it's good, because I hate that shit with a passion. I love Halloween 5 just as a movie. Like, I think it's just fucking great. But, like, those weird things about it, they make me, like, I love the movie for that. You know, Halloween 5 is very unique, and it's its own Halloween film. It's nothing like what came before. It's nothing like what came after it. You know, and I would argue that Halloween 5 is the last really good Halloween film until David Gordon Green's film.
Well, it's funny too, because like we're talking about Dominique's touches, like Ellie Cornell, who plays Rachel in the movie, has said, like, you know, she was given the instruction, like, make everything you do really sexy, like sex it up a bit. And she was like, my character is not sexy. Like, that's kind of the whole appeal of her overall. It's like, you know, you're walking your dog, make it sexy. It's like, how do you make walking your dog sexy? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So I will say, like, it's not a boring movie. One criticism you cannot heave at this movie as well, it's really dull. Like, that's absolutely untrue.
Well, that, and one of my favorite things has been to, like, watch interviews or read things with Dominique to where, you know, you find out these different directions that he gave everyone. Like, the bumbling cops, he told them to walk like penguins the whole movie. And then you go back and you watch the movie, and it's 100% that. Like, these things are just so fascinating to me. And as much as I just can't stand the cops, I do get this sense of enjoyment watching them walk around like penguins. You know, with Alan Howarth coming out with these little, like, boing sounds in the background.
So maybe one of you can explain, and I understand that, yeah, it's a tribute to Last House on the Left, and which is the most bizarre placement of bad cops ever in a movie. Like, that is just so out of left field. But, like, where did the idea for these two kind of, like, Keystone cops come from? They have the little circus music in the background, like, can anyone explain the genesis of those two characters?
I mean, my best, I don't know, I cannot explain it. I can theorize that it was like, you know, Ben Meeker was just such a hard-ass, no-nonsense kind of cop that maybe they thought there would be, like, some value in having, you know, like, the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just, you know, being a with as many cooks in the kitchen as there were in this film. Sure. Somehow, like, that's what we got out of it, is this nonsense.
That and
you know, because it's kind of a heavy movie if you think about it. It's an 8 or 9 year old girl that's traumatized. You know, her sister's killed early on. You know, I mean, it racks up a huge body count. You can see how somewhere along the line somebody would have been like, "Hey, let's add a little humor into this." And through, you know, script writing, telephone, you know, that's what ended up getting is like these two weirdo cops.
I think the intention, I mean, just from my point of view, the intention is just that. I mean, it's a very heavy movie. You know, they wanted to inject something to kind of like lower your, you know, anxiety for a little bit. And I think a good example of one of the movies in the series that kind of did that in a good way is adding like the humor with the character of Dave and, you know, other characters like the little boy in David Gordon Green's film, you know. It's not forced. It feels very natural to where you get used to these characters. You like these characters. They're making you laugh. And then something bad happens. And then, you know, that makes it intense again. Whereas Halloween 5, you know, they try to give you that. But maybe if they had done different sound effects and not like, you know, a kazoo or something in the background, it might have kind of worked better for the film.
Yeah, it's really the music that does them in. Them on their own really aren't doing anything overly comedic. It's not like they're falling down with pie in their face. You know, it's just that music is just so grating. You know, and it's like, I mean, let's not forget, this is a small town. You know, there might be some kind of just little, some dim-witted kind of people there, you know? Like, it's not unthinkable that there might be a couple of cops who are the sharpest tacks in the draw there.
Well, to your point, you know, I think that
they're not idiots. They're just a little, you know, they're used to nothing happening, you know? I mean, it's not really, apart from the music, it's not really that dissimilar from what they did with Will Patton when we were introduced to him drinking a Slurpee playing pinball, you know? I mean, the idea is that Haddonfield is not a town where a lot of shit happens usually. You know?
Well, to your point, it does kind of help explain how back-to-back years the whole police force is wiped out.
This is the second. Also, they're getting the third tier graduates here from the.
We'll take anyone at this point.
This would be like the graduates from Police Academy Part 6.
Yeah.
Would be.
The Under Siege, or Mission Moscow. But yeah, I mean, I would be really curious to show that movie to somebody stripped of that nonsense music to see, like, all right, what do you think of the two cops? It'd probably be like, what two cops? You know what I mean? Like, the music is what makes it really stick out, and unfortunately, it makes it stick out in an awful way.
Right.
Yeah.
What do we think about Rachel getting killed off so early in this movie?
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, no, honestly, like, I'll get a lot of shit for this, but it never bothered me once. Like, you know, Rachel, I think she's a good character, and I loved her character in 4. But when it comes to 5, I think as an audience, you know, I'm not saying kill off your main characters, but as an audience, you need to know that, you know, the bets are off. You need to know that the stakes are high. You need to know that not everyone is, you know, incapable of, you know, dying. And I think that killing off Rachel the way that it happened, it kind of shows that audience that kind of lived through those characters in the 4th film that, you know what, nobody's safe, you know? And I think it works for the film.
And also, like, what could she have done? What would she have done? She would have just been copying her beats from 4.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't much you can do. She's the protector. And it's just like, well, okay. And then she's going to keep protecting, you know? I mean, and they start her off kind of in the same situation. She's, you know, she loves her sister, but she's also got other plans. You know, she wanted to go to the cabin with her parents or whatever. And so it's just like, I can't imagine a version of that movie where she sticks around and has something particularly interesting to do beyond that Tina didn't end up doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's a time-honored slasher tradition to kill off somebody who you think is going to be out of town anyway, so that you don't know. You know, and that allows Jamie to have that reveal later, which is traumatizing for her.
Definitely.
Versus Rachel coming to her rescue again, as she already did in 4. So it's like,
No, I agree 100%. Mike, can you continue? I need to use the restroom real quick, but go ahead.
Sure.
I'll be right back.
Coming another time-honored tradition of Jerry getting to use the toilet during this. So yeah, I just actually went out and I did not even know that this book existed. So I just, Taking Shape, so I just ordered that because we used, when we did our Freddy versus Jason episode, like we cribbed so hard off of the...
No, there's a lot of, I mean, some of it I knew. There's other parts that are like tantalizingly underdeveloped. So it's like, oh, yeah, more on that. And then I don't go back to it. But, you know, it's good because you get to hear from a lot of people that you don't usually get to hear from. Mm-hmm. On these. It's not just John Carpenter being like, you know, we shot it in 3 weeks. You know, it's you know, the stories are new. And I like the angle. I like the approach of like, mm-hmm. here's what the movies could have been. Here's why this didn't happen or why that didn't happen. One thing I thought was really interesting, they point out, that never really occurred to me when Dimension lost the rights and Blumhouse got them, but they still had to work with Miramax. One, mm-hmm. you know, at first I remember people being like, well, why not just use the Marcus and Patrick script, or why not, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. Tom Thomas script or whatever. But it's just like, those were from the Dimension years. And right. if you use those, then Dimension has to get involved again, basically. So you had to have that clean slate because legally it would just be a complete freaking mess.
It'd be a nightmare.
Go back to that property. So they had to start with something that didn't even come close to what they were doing before.
I think it's important to kind of talk about the beginning a little bit. I mean, other than, because I mean, I always wanted to shine a light on the fact that Michael Myers floats, but he floats through water. No, but anyways, I think the original opening for Halloween 5 would have helped a lot of questions that all of us had, you know, with, you know, instead of the kind of reshoots that had the hermit added at the beginning, you know, mm-hmm. it was supposed to be this kind of young feral looking pagan called Dr. Death that brought Michael back. He was the one that did the kind of the thorn sign tattooed on him. And even there's little just shots in the actual final product that were from that Dr. Death time. You know, Michael wakes up, he's kind of on that kind of slab and there's pagan signs on there. You know, that's from that original Dr. Death, you know, pagan kind of beginning. That's how Michael was resurrected. But, you know, that didn't work. They reshot it with a hermit basically just nursing Michael Myers for a year. So, I mean, right from the beginning, you're kind of left with these questions like, well, what is going on? Where the original beginning that they shot, I think, would have helped people kind of know exactly what they're getting into.
Well, to me, this reshoot opening, too, it plays a bit like The Bride of Frankenstein, where you have the monster being cared for by someone who has no idea what he's in for. And it's just like, it's this bizarre thing where we're made to believe like a year has gone by, and then he just wakes up on Halloween night and there he is back to killing again. It was just, it's strange to me the way it all plays out.
You know, I'm curious because I think back in May or April, I think Sean Decker came across the actual footage that was shot of the original opening of Halloween mm-hmm. 5. I'm curious if that will ever be released and kind of give us that kind of new take on it.
Mm-hmm. And I think they even say like the way that the death was played out in that was, you know, much, much different. It could be a backbreaking death. And, you know, I think to your point, Jerry, it would have maybe made it a little bit more clear as to what the hell we were in for with the movie. As it is, it's just, it's a bizarre opening.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely.
This to me too is the movie where Donald Pleasance goes full Captain Ahab and just fully insane with Dr. Loomis. Like at this point, Loomis is not that far removed from Michael overall. And one of the running themes we've had when we've covered the Halloween series is how terrible Dr. Loomis is as a doctor. So we had Exhibit A in the original Halloween of like not doing his duty to warn and telling the police don't inform the public. Exhibit B was shooting his patient 6 times. That's usually not something you're supposed to do as a doctor. Halloween 2, he gets Ben Tramer killed basically by running around the streets waving a gun like a madman. In here, you know, Exhibit D and Dr. Loomis is a terrible doctor. You generally do not use a traumatized, like, 9 or 10-year-old girl as bait when you're trying to lure a serial killer into a trap. Usually the medical community is going to frown on this. This is not standard procedure.
I have always looked – I hear people giving Loomis a lot of shit for being this full-on, like, crazy mode in this one. But with that being said, this is a guy whose entire life basically –
It's a big failure, really.
Been trying to stop Michael, and especially the last 11 years of his life leading up to Halloween 5. Mm-hmm. I think by Halloween 5, Loomis's PTSD is front and center because that guy is just not okay. He knows that this will most definitely probably be his last act of trying to stop Michael. He knows it's kind of like go for broke this time, and I think he's kind of like slipping as far as like how far he would go to stop Michael. But yeah, he would lose his credibility, his medical license.
Well, I always wondered if Loomis had any other patients. Like, is it just Michael?
I hope not.
They should make a film all about like a patient was neglected by Loomis, just like waiting for his therapy to go.
Well, one of the things we talked about when we first talked about the first Halloween movie was like Loomis. After like eight, when he's like, I spent like 7 years trying to reach him and 8 years trying to keep him locked up. It's like, dude, if after 7 years you've had no impact as a therapist, like you got to give him to another therapist at that point. Like you should not be treating someone for 7 years and making no progress. Like that's just so unethical. It hurts. So
but honestly, in his defense though, Loomis does use a little kid as bait. But, I mean, let's think about who Michael's next doctor is. I mean, Sartain, I think, is a much, like, a bigger asshole than Loomis ever is.
He's the worst looking doctor.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, no wonder he's made no progress in, like, 40 years. Like, it's just not. So, well, I don't know.
That's probably why he's standing there at the beginning of David Gordon Green's Michael, is because he's just like, okay, well, first I had the bald guy that was shooting me nonstop, and now I have this guy that just wants me to talk 24/7. Mm-hmm. Like, do I ever get a break?
Well, I do like in the making of. No, you first, Brian. What's up?
No, I was looking at Michael being like, do any of you actually want to help me? Fuck.
He's like, I'm just trying to exist, and this new doctor's driving me to this girl I tried to kill. Like, I have no desire to go after her.
And I love that, like, Loomis's plan to capture Michael involves, like, a Scooby-Doo, like, net and a stick. And, like, hitting him with a stick. Like, it is, like, number one, where does he get the net from? Like, does he just, like, keep this in his trunk? Like, in case of emergency, fishing net. Michael
stole the stuff from in the first movie.
It's pretty incredible. And, you know, I think when you watch in the making of documentary of this, it's on the Blu-ray, Daniel Harris is like, yeah, you know, like, Pleasance was having a few pops in his trailer in between takes. You know, he's like, I didn't quite know at the time what that was on his breath, but now I know. Like, it is and it's fun. Like, by all means, like, this is not a bad performance. Like, it is a lot of fun to watch, but my God, it is completely unhinged.
It's kind of like, it's kind of the equivalent of, like, Nicolas Cage in Vampire's Kiss, but... Like, I just, I don't know, man. I love it. I love Loomis in Halloween 5. Like, it's a completely different side of the character. It's Loomis just, like, knowing, like, shit, dude, I have no idea what to do at this point, so I'm just going to go for it.
It's interesting because he has his most nuanced moment in part 4, I think, in the truck stop scene. I think that's, like, Loomis's best moment in the whole series, and it's a nuanced, almost quiet moment, and you go from that to like him pulling a gun on a cop and also like shaking this 9-year-old girl, demanding that she give him information about this like psychic connection that she shares with his uncle. Like, all of a sudden he believes her, you know, telepathically linked. It's just interesting to see like what a change a year makes.
Well, I mean, but you also do get Loomis basically begging Michael again in 5. You know, after Tina is killed, you know, he knows that Michael is in the woods. He's trying to basically talk him he's trying to talk him, you know, into coming to the house this time, you know, as opposed to the part four where he's trying to beg him not to go to Haddonfield. It's different, but I still think that that scene kind of plays similar to Holland 4.
So speaking of...
I'm here for Crazy Loomis, because, you know, just... there's something... I mean, when I was a kid, when I was younger watching these movies, the Loomis character is what helped really set these apart from the Fridays and Nightmares to me. It was just having that, you know, continued character who's actually played by the same actor every time. And I love, you know, their relationship. And I do love that, you know, I don't know if it fully works, but you get that, you know, the quote-unquote human side of Michael in this one. Mm-hmm. And they have that nice moment where, you know, Michael... He comes up to him menacingly, but then he stops, and he's not, like, just trying to kill Loomis. You know, he's, like, seemingly listening to him for a second. And I like that kind of stuff. And I really love the part that after Tina gets killed and all the cops drive away, and he's just talking to him in the woods. I like that part a lot, too. You know, and Loomis is kind of dialed down with the craziness there, too, which is nice. Also, I mean, it's just funny to me now watching the movie on Blu-ray after years of VHS and even DVD, because you could just see these things so clearly now that I couldn't, you know, I was watching this movie over and over when I was 11 or 12. I never could tell that you could actually see Michael's face when he sits up at the hermit's place. And yeah. I could never find Michael in the woods in that scene. Now it's like it clear as day. You can see him.
No, totally. I agree.
No, it is.
Kids actually have no idea how lucky they are to that. You know, when they're forming their love of movies and watching, you know, the five that they own over and over again, that they'll be on Blu-ray and they can actually see everything clearly.
Well, it's like in part four, there's that moment when he's in the background in the house when cop and the girl are having the conversation. And I never noticed that until the last time I watched this movie, and I had never ever noticed that part before. So you're right. Like,
oh, really?
I used to.
Couldn't see it clearly, but I could see the, you know, the white. Yeah, I could never ever find them there in that wood scene before.
I think that was how it was.
That was always hard to see on VHS too. When Rachel's walking around by herself and she just says, all of a sudden she just goes, "Oh God!" and starts running. Like, on VHS, I was always confused. Like, what does she see?
There's the first one. I remember when Blu-ray came out, there was the first one where Loomis is talking to Brackett and Michael kind of looks both ways before turning. And that's, like, really clear in the Blu-ray that it just adds, like, a little bit of humor when I watch it.
So, I think the reason this movie gets a lot of hatred is Tina, played by Wendy Kaplan at the time. In this movie, like... researching for this episode, like, if you type into Google, like, Halloween 5 Tina, the first thing that comes up is annoying when you do the autocorrect overall. And I really think that's an unfair, because there's, like, so many articles, like, is Tina the worst character in all of the Halloween franchise? And I think that's a really unfair thing to say about her, because I kind of love this character.
What's crazy is, I mean, growing up, I was one of those people. I had nothing positive to say about Tina, and it was only this last year that I was showing my wife Halloween 5 for the first time because she hadn't seen it. And she kind of pointed out, she's like, well, why do you not like that character? It's like, she has the same exact personality as Dahlia, my daughter. And seeing that, like, I noticed all these little things about the characters, just like, why am I annoyed with that? You know, that's just, there's so many things, you know, that, like, maybe, like, nuances and just personality quirks that I think I unfairly looked at. You know, I wrote an article basically apologizing to the character of Tina, because, like, now watching it, like, she is one of my favorite characters. And it's weird how people can change over time.
I thought you were going to go really dark there and say that I realized I really hated my kid. So glad we did not go that way.
Right?
Whew, dodged a bullet.
No, but I think there are so many other characters in the Halloween series that are just far more annoying than Tina. I mean, I just cannot stand the Bud character in Halloween 2. I mean, oh my God, I can't stand that dude. I mean, there's so many. I think Tina... I mean, she has a lot of personality. Like, we all know people like that. That mm-hmm. doesn't make them, like, annoying at all. It's just who they are. And I think one of the biggest things that kind of speaks on how great that character is, you know, like, as wild and kind of, like, in-your-face as that character tends to be, when everything goes down, she is the one that basically runs to be murdered just so Jamie can get away. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so many characters in the series run the opposite way when things, you know, like, when the shit hits the fan. Tina is a character, kind of like Rachel in the fourth one, that puts herself on the line 24/7 just to make sure this little kid, who really isn't related to her whatsoever, survives. Yeah. I think Tina is one of the most noble characters in the series.
Yeah. Yeah, I never got the hate for her. I mean, yeah, she, the bop it up, you know, like, some of that stuff. Yeah, so she's a little ditzy and annoying, but, like, in the end, she's a great character who sacrifices herself to save a little girl, like you said, that she's not even related to. It's just like, has there anybody in the series been that noble? You know, like, no, there's not a lot of, like, sacrifice going on here. It's usually just people kind of getting in the way and getting killed. So I don't know. Yeah. Again, with most of this movie, it's just, I've never quite figured out where the hate came from.
Yeah.
I think, too, like, Jerry, you had said she plays everything really big, and she does. And I think, like, this is the kind of character that growing up, like, I would have loved to have hung out with her. Are you kidding me? Like, she's loud, she's funny, she's a bit crass, but and she's one of the few characters, like, she's really in charge of her sexuality overall. Like, I think her sexuality is kind of what saves her when she first encounters Michael, with that scene in the car when he's wearing that monster mask, because he's so thrown off by her, he doesn't even know how to react in that moment. He's like, this is too much for even me right now.
I also think that that is one of the best scenes in the entire series.
Oh yeah,
like, one of them. I think it's terrifying. I mean, knowing we also get a return of Michael Myers playing pranks on people in that scene, you know, kind of like what he does a lot in the first film. You know, Michael wearing that mask, he could kill her at any time. He, in any moment, he doesn't. He likes playing with it. But when, like you said, he's kind of like taken back by it. Tina has such a personality that it catches him off guard, and it even angers him. Her personality does, you know, you see the gloves kind of like clench the will, like he wants to kill her so bad, you know, but it just doesn't happen.
Well, and two, it's almost like he's fighting with his instinct to want to kill somebody for having sex, which just runs throughout all of the movies, to the point where even in this movie, like, the character that gets killed for having sex is literally wearing a devil costume. I mean, you cannot really hit that metaphor more on the nose if you were wearing boxing gloves and in a ring with it.
I will say though that the devil thing, Tina was originally supposed to wear that. They didn't want the kind of heroine to wear it, so they switched it last moment to Sam.
But what does that say, though? Like, your character, like, who's, like, smart and sexual and, like, out there, like, oh, but she can't be the devil. You know, like, that, the one you're supposed to root for can't be sexy. Like, nope, that's evil. Like, this, you know, and I know we've argued, not really argued, but we've said before, like, I don't think that the original Halloween was supposed to be this anti-sex movie overall, but that's the lesson that was taken from it, and it just carries over in a really big way, and like really on the nose way here.
Well, even when a lot of those movies didn't have the intention, I think by the time sequel and after sequel comes out, I think eventually they do play into that kind of forced mythology that a lot of people put into those movies at first.
Right. So you can see him fighting with his instincts here, where he, you know, maybe is even a little bit attracted to her, and he's fighting with that, those kind of dual impulses at that point. So, but I really like this character, and to me, like, in a series of films where you have Busta Rhymes saying "Trick or treat, motherfucker," and doing kung fu, there's no way that Tina ranks as the most annoying character at all in any of these movies.
I mean, dude, you have two movies later, you have a security guard that is arguing with his wife the whole time while writing romance novels. Like, Tina's the most annoying thing. I mean, you have a protagonist two movies later that can't even comb his fucking hair. And Tina is the most annoying one.
Right.
You got little man Tate as a sidekick in H2O, but Tina is the most annoying.
Yeah. I really can't stand the kids, and I mean, John and Wally are fine, but their two friends are just the pits, I think.
Yeah.
Apart from the Resurrection kids, who are just all awful, including the main one. I don't even like the main girl in that one.
Right.
But, stop hating on 5. There's so much worse in the series.
Right? 5 is fun. I mean, like, watching it again, it's a fun movie.
Well, that, and, I mean, it exists in, like I said, in its own little bubble. Mm-hmm. Like it's such a weird, weird movie. And I mean that as the highest of compliments. You know, there are things about it that drive me nuts. You know, that kind of 20% that I mentioned earlier. You know, the cops. But the Men in Black, like, I, to this day, even with the Dan Farron's explanation in 6, I still do not get the Men in Black in 5. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy gets off the bus, kicks a dog, basically stalks Loomis the whole time, and then at the end pulls out an Uzi and breaks Michael out of jail. Like, and what's, you know, if you read the interviews or the behind-the-scenes stuff or the documentaries, I mean, that was inspired by a random guy watching them film. The idea that they took a random dude wearing all black, and, oh man, we need that as like a subplot. Like, it's so just batshit insane that, like, you just almost have to love it. And, like, I remember when the film came out, you had that ending, and it's just like, well, first of all, even as a kid, I was like, wait, it feels weird seeing Michael Myers sitting in jail. And second, like, this guy, smoke and red lights and machine guns, like, where is this series going to go? To where, like, even as frustrating as it was, I was so excited to wait that, you know, 5-6 years to see where it went. And unfortunately, it went somewhere that I wish it wouldn't have. But, I mean, I think 5 sets up, like, a really interesting possible take on what would come after it.
And where did you guys think it was going to go at the time? Like, looking back 30 years, you know, that was all the speculation. What were your thoughts? Like, was it Michael's brother? Was it...
I can say that I had a theory when I watched it, but I would be lying. I had no idea where it was going to go. I couldn't even come up with like a theory because it's such a batshit insane ending. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And I know if you listen to the Halloween 5 Blu-ray commentary that Don Shanks did with Justin Beam, I mean, Don Shanks said that he was understanding that maybe the Men in Black was Michael's brother or an alternate personality, which both sound really weird to me. But I mean, I don't know. I never knew, even as a kid. I had no clue where it was going to go. What about you, Brian?
I don't remember like the details of why I landed on this, but I just remember as a kid thinking it was somebody that wanted revenge on Michael themselves, and they're like, they wanted to do it. Like, because I remember like thinking it was Brackett, maybe. Like, it was somebody who was like, no, I can't let the cops deal this. I'm going to bust him out so I can kill him myself, kind of thing. I don't know why I landed on that, but that's in my memory. That's what I had.
I mean, I would have loved if they could have done something truly interesting and, you know, given Jamie Lee Curtis like a dump truck full of money one movie earlier and make her the Woman in Black at that point looking to break him out. But that's just not the world that we live in, unfortunately.
You know, maybe they'll do a Terminator Genesis thing with Halloween 5.
Please don't. Please don't do that. That would be bad. That would be very bad. But yeah, it is interesting. You have this like these little moments that are interspersed throughout the movie of this guy, and then it ends with him pulling a John Rambo to the police force once again of Haddonfield, who once again go down in a hail of bullets without even nicking the dude. And it continues the tradition that I think Halloween is pretty well known for. 5 movies in, 4 of them have had complete downers of an ending.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even with the ending, I mean, this is kind of off topic, I guess, a little bit. But, I mean, speaking on, like, people kind of unfairly hating Halloween 5, we do get one of the best sequences in the entire series. Mm-hmm. Towards the finale, you know, with the kind of chase between Jamie and Michael in the house. I can't think of a single like moment other than like, you know, a lot from the first film that scares me to this day watching it. It's intense to watch. And especially if you're a parent, I mean, that does change things. You can't deny it. But watching it as a parent, seeing Michael Myers try to stab this little girl through the laundry chute, like, it's hard to watch for me.
Yeah, and you have that weird but not terrible moment where Jamie, like, climbs into her own coffin, essentially, and is ready to just sacrifice herself. Like, she's just given up at that point. Yeah. And she's, like, has that, like, uncle moment where, like, Michael Myers cries. And it's bizarre. Like, it's this really, really strange moment. But it kind of works for me.
You look just like me.
Mm-hmm. Well, deep down, we're all people, too.
I'm just wondering, I'm still just wondering how his eyes grew back after two. I mean, that was my biggest thing as a kid. Like, it's cool that he's crying, but, I mean, how does he see? No, but I think it's funny that, I mean, I remember when 5 came out on the back of the VHS, if I remember correctly, it was just like, finally, Michael Myers will be unmasked. Mm-hmm. And all you see, like, you know, especially in the VHS days, you can't see Don Shanks in the background when he rises up that well. All you got with the VHS is basically a close-up on his eye for half a second. And I remember even as a kid being like...
A really good projection. Michael Myers is unmasked.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, you can see him pretty clear, like you had said before. You can see him pretty clear in that scene at the beginning. And you can see him pretty well, I think, in the basement. And I think the original idea, too, was they were going to make him very deformed. And they decided not to go that route and just kind of keep him in the shadows at that point. So the original idea would have been like a makeup-heavy scene, but they decided not to go that route. What do we think of Don Shanks' performance overall as Michael Myers? I think it's kind of a mix between the traditional version of the shape, but also he still has that, what we saw at the beginning of part 4, that kind of Jason Voorhees side to him now, where the deaths tend to be a lot more violent than they were in the first couple movies. But it's still maybe a better version of like the classic shape than what we saw in part 4 and even part 2.
Yeah, for me, a lot of it always just comes down to the mask. I don't think anybody was good or bad, you know, was bad really at Michael. Mm-hmm. Even the guy in Resurrection, you know, it's just mostly just it depends on the mask and what the script is having them doing. They all, I mean, except for the reshoot guy in 6, none of them run, which to me would be like the worst thing. You know, they all kind of get that right sort of slow walk, creepy, watching from the shadows kind of thing going on.
I think that Don Shanks played it kind of how Rob Zombie hoped that it would be played in his films. You know, Don Shanks obviously isn't as big or as tall as, like, maybe Tyler Mane, but there is that kind of, like, bigger, you know, a little more vicious kind of look to him. You know, in my opinion. And I really love what Don Shanks did with the movie. I think he's one of my favorite performers of the shape, I think.
Yeah, and I would say I love the performance in part 6 of Michael Myers. I'm really fascinated to talk about that movie next week. But this one, you know, what I noticed in the latest watch through of it is it does have a lot more of Michael kind of lurking in the shadows overall. And I really, that to me is like what Michael Myers is all about. Like, he's not someone that is coming running out at you and is like kind of in your face. But I really do enjoy the performance overall.
I do too. I think it's a really good movie. I mean, like we've said quite a few times, I think it's unfairly judged. I think maybe people had these big expectations after 4 because, I mean, when you talk to people, you know, 9 out of 10 people will cite 4 a lot higher than 5. But I do think it is its own thing, and I think it's very successful in doing what it set out to be. And I also think Dominique is he's unfairly judged when it comes to anything wrong with this film. Mm-hmm.
So what else do we have to say, my friends? Like, where else? Am I missing anything here in Halloween 5, or have we covered it as well as we're going to cover it?
I think I'm good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think we got all of it. Leave 5 alone now.
Stop picking on it. It's like the stuttering redheaded stepchild.
For fun, just because we were just talking about Don Shanks, I will tell at the, let's see, which one was it? It would have been the 30th anniversary convention, I believe. we got trapped in an elevator at the hotel that it was at. Like, because like there was just probably like three more people in that elevator than there should have been at any given time. And who pried the doors open for us?
Don Shanks.
From the other side. He wasn't even in there with us. He was just like heard the commotion and came to the rescue. So it's just like a bunch of fucking, you know, morons that are like here for like a weekend of Halloween revelry, and Michael Myers comes to the door to rescue you.
There you go. Halloween 5 rescues people.
Yeah, so stop picking on this movie, people. It's, to me, it encapsulates late 80s movies. Like, there's the weirdness to it, gives it that kind of like Stunning Steve Savage kind of feel to it, the dude who made like movies like Better Off Dead. Like, there's just this bizarre weirdness to it. The fashions are pure late 80s overall. Like, it's a nice time capsule of like that period of horror movies overall, and it is a lot of fun. Like, it's the kind of movie that I think, like, if you were just throwing something on in the background for a Halloween party, it would play really well, I think, overall. Especially things like the barn scene and like the party scene would play really well.
Also, one of the last, like, until the, I don't think their names are the most recent one, the last one for a long time that didn't have the Weinsteins on it. So There's something good about it.
Something in the positive column as well overall. So, Brian, tell us a little bit, like, what are you working on right now? Where can our listeners find you on the web? And, like, what do you got that you're working on right now?
I write a weekly column for Birth, Movies, Death called Colin's Crypt, which is usually just, like, me just kind of almost like an essay, just, you know, whatever, if Scream Factory has a new thing or whatever it is, I'll find something and just speak my mind a bit. Horror Movie Day, I still update when I can. It's not every day anymore, obviously. What else? They paid me, so I hope it made the cut, but if not, I still got paid, so I don't care. I should have an article in next month's Fangoria. So I'm very excited about that, because I've written for the site, but I've never had an article in the actual magazine before, so I'm very very excited about that.
What's the article?
It'll be
none of your business.
Fittingly for what we're talking about tonight, it'll be defending another maligned slasher. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Maybe you can use your imagination and think about what might be coming out next month, and process of elimination.
What are your thoughts on Kathy's Curse? Just kidding.
So you wanted to wrap this up. So we got another hour? Great. All right.
I think
you can also find me at the Kathy's Curse audio commentary, of course.
More people have seen that movie because of you. I think that's that movie you've championed so much that people have just seen it almost out of spite at this point.
Not anymore for a while. If you Googled the movie, my review came up before the IMDb. I was very proud of that.
That's great.
So when Horror Movie A Day was running strong, what was the final tally on the number? I thought, was it like in the 2500s, like the number?
Yeah, I stopped at 2500. Yeah.
Jesus. And what did you find, like, out of curiosity, like, when you ended doing that every single day, like, because that was such a, you have to go home, like, pop a movie in, write about it. Like, how did your life change at that point? Like, did you find, like, I don't know what to do with these extra 2 hours? Or was it a relief?
It was so weird for, like, the first couple weeks. And every now and then, like, randomly, like 2 years later, every now and then, it would just say, like, probably depending on how tired I was, I would be driving home, because I work late a lot. I'd be driving home, like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night from work, and just be like suddenly like, fuck, I still have to watch a movie too. And like, it would take like 30 seconds for me to be like, wait, no, don't.
Don't have flashbacks like anymore.
So that was what I was thinking. But yeah, it was weird because I thought I would have so much extra time. It just filled in with other things. These delusions of like, oh man, because this is like 4 hours of my day back between watching the movie and writing a review. I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna finally finish The Sopranos. I'm gonna read more books. I'm gonna do this and that. It just filled up with like other bullshit, you know. So I could probably still do it. I would just, you know, it'd just be like, what am I giving up instead? Maybe I'm gonna give up Twitter, you know, or something, or Candy Crush, or whatever the hell it may be, you know, like any of these other things that, you know, you waste your time on. I could just start this again. I won't, but you know, it was just very interesting to me to realize that it wasn't like a big gap of time opened itself up.
And when you see, like, because we're just after the Halloween season now, and you have people that are like 31 horror movies in 31 days, yeah. Are you ever like, you fucking lightweights?
Yeah, it's funny, my friend Dick Grenart, who is a screenwriter, he was trying to do a 31 day challenge thing, and he came up one or two short. He said he like fell asleep on the last one. I'm like, you coward! But no, I mean. It's funny. The only time I ever missed one was like the 10 days in or something like that. Mm-hmm. That was the only time I missed a day. It got so much easier as time went on. Mm-hmm. It was harder to do it at first, but after a while, it just became part of the day. And so these guys that try to do it for a month, I'm impressed when they manage, because even me, I couldn't do it for the first month. It's really difficult to just start doing that and keep up with it versus, when you've been doing it for 4 years. Yeah, it's not that difficult.
It's like the couch to 5K challenge, except you just sit on your couch the whole time. So how about the book? How is the book different from the site? Like, what did you add to that over just reprinting all the reviews? Like, how did you...
The book has a little excerpt from the review, but for the most part, it's new writing. It's me reflecting on the movie, like, now, because in some cases the reviews were close to 10 years old at that point. Some of them were movies I didn't like at the time, but I kind of came around on. So it was a lot of, just like, okay, so maybe I was a little harsh on this one, or... at the time I thought this is kind of decent, but, I keep thinking about it now, and that sort of thing. So, then other times it would just be like a little like random anecdote, like, I ended up meeting the guy that made this movie, and, he gave me a job, doing the credits for his next one, or, whatever. So it's just all stuff like that. It's mostly, because the thing is, I was doing this, I was not watching, I was only watching movies I hadn't seen before. Or saw when I was a kid and couldn't really remember anything. So it wasn't like I was like, today's movie's going to be Halloween. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't doing the stuff that I had seen and knew. So it was all, a lot of obscure stuff, apart from obviously the newer movies that were coming out. And so I would be watching them in a complete bubble. I wouldn't know anything about them except that they were horror. I'd just load up my Netflix queue, my Blockbuster queue. I would get those budget packs, which is how I found Kathy's Curse. That's a perfect example. I knew nothing about Kathy's Curse. It was just a movie that was on my little Mill Creek budget pack that, I looked on the back. It was like, it's 82 minutes or whatever. I'm like, all right, perfect, fine. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Sounds like an Exorcist ripoff. Okay. I just have to watch a movie for the day. Like, I don't have to find one that I'm really desperate to see every day.
Right.
And so I've tried to recreate that for the reader. I didn't want to give them too much about them. And I saw one review, like, one of the reviews was, like, kind of annoyed by that. It was just like, you're not telling me anything. I'm like, that's intention. I don't want you to know too much. I want you to have that same level, zero expectations that I did for all these. Because that's the best way to watch a movie, I think. If I tell you that this movie's amazing and it's the best movie of the year, blah, 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 you're going to go in expecting The Exorcist. And it's not. Right. It might not even be as good as Exorcist 2, but, like, it stuck out for one reason or another. The write-ups and the excerpts from the reviews are kind of purposely vague. I'm just giving you enough to, like, let you know if it's the kind of movie you think you'd be into. I personally, I'm not a huge fan of haunted house movies. I like Poltergeist and Conjuring, but very few others. I don't flock to them. So if I see somebody says like, oh, there's a haunted house movie that's pretty good, I'm going to be like, okay, well, I probably won't watch it. If it's not mind-blowing, I'm not going to be into it. But if I do love Evil Children movies. So if somebody's like, oh, I saw an Evil Children movie. I'm like, tell me no more. Just tell me the title and I'm going to go watch it, you know? So, I don't know. Like, that was basically what I was trying to do. Whether I was successful is up to the reader.
Well, it's interesting, too, if I remember, because it's been a while since I've read the book, it's kind of arranged by subgenre. Like, you have a month and then a subgenre, and you'll do, like, 30, 31 movies based on that overall. So it's interesting. Yeah, so if someone... You know, to me, it's like for someone who's like, hey, I love like sci-fi horror, then you can like go to that chapter and then, you know, find those titles if you might not have like picked out. And like that joy of discovery is like what really, I think, made the site and made the book such a fun read. Which readers, by the way, the book for our Kindle, if people have Kindles, like it's $5 on Kindle. Like that's an easy $5 to spend, right? Matter of fact, we should just do a giveaway, I think, at this point. So we'll do a giveaway to one of our listeners over the course of this week after this episode comes out, because it really is a book that belongs in, I think that, and I think Scott Weinberg's like A to Z horror book are like two that really belong in any horror movies fans collection overall. So, well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. We hope this was fun for you and that you'll come back and talk to us at some point, because we had a blast doing this.
And where can... for Resurrection, I'll get drunk and I'll just be 90 minutes of ranting if you want.
We may take you up on that.
Right?
We might take you up. So, Jerry, what do we have next week?
What do we have next week? What's after this one? No, I'm just kidding. Halloween 6. I'm worried about that episode because it's kind of like the Jason Goes to Hell episode for me, which I think Jason Goes to Hell and Book of Shadows are the only two episodes we've done where I'm just I look back and I'm like, man, I was not a nice person. You were very sour. Yeah, exactly. And I'm trying not to be that way, but I just have such a distaste for six. But we do have someone who loves it, Anya Stanley. She's gonna be on the show. We're supposed to have Dan Farrens on a side episode. I need to touch base and make sure he still wants to do it. But that's what we have. That is next week.
So are you going to just come on and are you just going to trash him? Like the whole...
No. Like, I'm not going to diss Dan Farrens. I just want to hear, you know, what went through his head.
I'm picturing like that episode from The Office when Michael is doing his exit interview for Toby. And he's like, why are you like you way you are right now? What gives you the right?
As long as I don't get a significant other hating me again, like Adam Marcus's wife hates me now.
There are a couple, man. You're pissing a lot of wives off, basically, during the course of the show.
Yeah, but next week, Halloween 6, it'll be fun. It'll be a fun, positive thing.
Thank you, listeners. We hope you enjoyed this. If you're enjoying what we do, please go to iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify. Leave us a review. That's huge for us. Like, the more reviews we get, we're now seeing our show pop on like other listeners subscribe to, and there's like a bunch of other shows we really love, like Keep Screaming, UVHS, we the Geeks, who are like listed alongside them. So it helps people find us, because we don't want to do this show in a vacuum. So you know, go ahead, leave us a review, follow us over at Pod and Pendulum over on Twitter. If you like this, like my daughter and I, we actually just recorded a director's commentary for Shaun of the Dead. So if you want to hear what a 9-year-old girl who's had way too much sugar before recording a director's commentary or fan commentary, go ahead and give that a download, because that was a lot of fun to do. Not a lot of insight, surprisingly enough, when it comes to the movie, but still, I think it was a really fun listen. And we'll hear from you guys next week.